So my talk I've described as Libre Planet. And really this comes from last year's meeting. At last year's meeting, we had this first members forum, and we put forward a request of members about what it is that you think we should be working on in the coming year. And one of those things, it turned out, was DRM. Now, what's really interesting about this meeting is that always the day after this meeting, we have the FSF board members meeting. So it's everyone's juices are flowing after this meeting, and we get to make some decisions at the meeting. And last year, thanks to Eben Moglen's thinking about how we can help progress with GPLv3, and thanks to the conversation we had at last year's members meeting, we decided to launch our campaign against DRM, defective by design. So with the launch of that campaign, we were asking an important question, which is, can technologists be social activists? Now, the year started, our meeting last year was on April 1st, but the year started for us really with the Daniel Wallace case, good old Daniel Wallace. And this judgment, this statement by a US federal judge, John Daniel Tinder, where he described that basically he settled it. You know, we've heard for so many years now the GPL, it's not, you know, it's not enforceable, blah, 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 blah. And it's a license, it's not a contract. But, you know, at last we have a judge who in a very short space of time can look at the license and make a statement like that. So for me, and I think thanks to people like Pamela Jones and Grocklaw, we got to a point where we could kind of put that conversation behind us about this license. The license is fine. So that's where we started the year. So are technologists social activists? Now, what do we mean by that? What do I mean by that? Well, of course, we're social activists. Now, Richard has been the one who's proved it more than probably anybody else. You know, his power of will, his skill as a hacker, and his strong thinking about the fundamental underpinnings of what makes free software live is social activism. And that's all very well and good, but can we get people out on the streets? The answer to that, as it turned out, was yes, we can. Defective by Design launched on May 23rd, 2006 in Seattle, Washington, at WinHEC, Microsoft Developers Conference, where Bill Gates was given the keynote speech. It turns out he wasn't actually there. He was given the keynote speech by remotely. But anyway, the point was made. And suddenly we were in the process of showing that, you know, all that anger that we'd seen for a year, 2 years, 3 years about DRM, all the stories on Slashdot, all that, you know, comments on it, that weren't really going anywhere. We were getting more DRM. The DRM was inevitable. It's the new business models. It's the way that, you know, people want their media. As technologists, we knew that was rubbish. We were saying so, but there was nothing going to stop it. Nothing was really putting an end to DRM. And so what was important about this campaign, and I think what we've helped make happen, is that people have realized that they don't have to accept it. And if we can be loud enough about it, and, you know, not just our campaign, but everybody else who's saying against DRM, if there can be a continual messaging that DRM is unacceptable to us, it's unacceptable to consumers, citizens, as we prefer to call them, then that's the way to stop DRM. We could attempt to overturn the DMCA, but much more realistically, in the time frame that we've got ahead of us, actually doing some activism is our best approach. So, poor Bill. But of course, it wasn't just about Microsoft, and it's never just about Microsoft. It's also about Apple. So, this is our famous image from the campaign that sort of really sums it up. iPod plus iTunes plus DRM locks you in. No free software, no future for us. So, you know, It's not even been a year yet since we've launched the campaign, and we've now got more than 20,000 people who have joined the campaign, taken that pledge to take direct action in some form, whether it be coming out on the streets or more likely just digging a story for us on Dig. But you know, the people will come out on the streets, and it's these kinds of actions which have an enormous effect, because people don't expect it of us, in a sense. You know, we have been social activists, but we've been hacking, and that's great. But what I'm suggesting today is that we've got to a point now where we've won that. We've won the hacking front in many ways, and really what we need to do now is quickly push for adoption of free software. And really, that is happening already. And it kind of for us, the campaign kind of came to a pinnacle on October 3rd, the day against DRM. We had over 200 actions, mostly in the US and in Europe, people handing out stickers, you know, doing their own thing, you know, not directed by us, I might point out, but but you know, this is the point. You know, Henry Poole from Civic Actions, who's a board member of the FSF and who's also runs Civic Actions, who partnered with us in the campaign. You know, he described about how campaigns really need to activate what's referred to as the edge, get people, actual people, to do their own thing without control by us. You know, it's not about a centrally controlled campaign. It's about getting the idea that people can take action, and it's through individuals doing action that we can see some amazing things happen. And that's been the truth of the campaign all along. In the UK, one of our members started a petition to the UK government, to Tony Blair, saying we should ban DRM. And it got a lot of attention. Wasn't controlled by us, wasn't done by us, but he declared himself as being for Defected by Design, doing this part of an anti-DRM campaign. And that's really what that edge is about, letting people go off and do their thing under the umbrella of the campaign. Now, what happens is, once you've hit a point where we don't like DRM and we're not taking it anymore, anyone who brings a product to market, before it's even hit now, any DRM product that comes to market, whether it be Amazon's Unbox or whether it be the iPod, it's dead on arrival. And that's a really important thing. You know, when we started this campaign, it was about where are the three places we can apply pressure. And one of them is on manufacturers. You know, if we can show them their products aren't going to be accepted, then we can maybe start to make them think about changing the direction they're going. We want to send a message to the manufacturers, which is that we want a relationship with you as your customers. You shouldn't be working for the media industry here. You should be working with us to get the products that we want, and don't sort of be reliant upon the film and music industry for your business. This is one of my favorite actions that we took. This is going back to Amazon Unbox. Amazon have this really interesting idea where you can tag products with different, so you can find them and search them later, like cool video or whatever. So you can search cool video and up all the cool videos come. So we started tagging products defective, and then you'll see there's over 1,000 items now tagged by 532 customers. So it's 532 people have taken the time, customers of Amazon, to tag products. And good old Chris there, 450 products. That must have taken days, I can tell you. It takes ages to tag one product. It's a pain. So that was a big effort there by Chris. But, you know, so it's about getting a message out. And now the media, you know, the point of the campaign is, how can we make DRM a real issue? And now it is a real issue. You know, whether it be the fact that Steve Jobs has to come forward and say there's a problem with DRM, or whether there's, some kind of consumer rights groups in Europe, you know, saying that DRM is unacceptable and, you know, it has to be changed. You have to open it up. You have to do something with it. It's not good for our citizens. It's all been very, very interesting and effective. Now, alongside that, obviously, there are lots of other things going on. And one thing I want to point out is what happened at the end of the year, with Free Rhizome campaign. Now, Rhizome is one of these multiplayer games, 3D games online that you can play. Rhizome had gone bankrupt, and there was this attempt to actually purchase it by members of the free software movement. They wanted to go out and buy the engine, buy all the graphics, all that creative work as well, put it under the GPL, and kind of try and break into with free software into that area. It was a very, very interesting attempt. The group still exists now. They refer to themselves now as the Virtual Citizenship Association. The FSF at the time got involved, pledged to support them. If they were successful with the bid, we would help them with funding. Now, what was interesting about that was after it failed, the bid failed, it turns out that Linden Lab then followed very quickly up with releasing their client as free software under the GPL. So with the launch of Microsoft's Vista to the general public, on that day that we were protesting in New York, there was a protest inside Second Life at the launch using our graphics. Again, nothing to do with us, just people taking it upon themselves as activists to go out and do this. She's pretty nice. That's me, actually. No. That's the trouble with Second Life, isn't it, really? and this is where we are now. He's only got a few days left. He's going to be getting a nasty surprise. But, you know, 6,000 signatures in 16 days. Again, telling the story, you know, that it's not, you can't pass the buck, you can't pass the blame. DRM is your fault to a large degree. So the things we pointed out to Steve Jobs is that he has control with DRM as it applies to independent artists. We know there are lots of groups, bands out there who have control of their own back catalogs and they control their destiny as artists, and they don't want DRM, but Steve won't let them distribute without DRM. He's also, as we know, the largest single shareholder in Disney, heads up Pixar. He could do that for video. And of course, maybe in some ways, the one thing that I'd love Steve Jobs to do, which is to take a stand against the DMCA and fund an effort to repeal the restrictions on technology that circumvent DRM. So those are the sorts of things we pointed out that he can do. And you know, there's this real effort and understanding, I think, going on that we can make a change as artists and technologists. So here we have some artists and we have some leaders in the technology field: Cory Doctorow, Perry Barlow, Lawrence Lessig, obviously Richard Stallman. All these people, you know, these are the range of people who take a stand against DRM. But where do we go with it from now? I mean, we're a small population of users in some ways. So one thing that we want to do is try to get the message out beyond us. You know, how do we do that? So one of the ways from my background, I determined, I used to work at this magazine called The New Internationalists. It's based in the UK. Well, actually, no, it's not based in the UK. They've got offices in England, in Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, editorial offices. And but not much of a presence here in the United States. And it's one of the largest distributed monthly magazines, and it covers world development issues, whether it be from green politics to environmentalism to the World Bank. And for my mind, coming from this world to free software, and what I've learned about free software, I believe free software belongs in that world. And so I've been talking with the editorial team of New Internationalists for a while now, trying to get them interested. And the problem is, of course, they're not technologists. It scares the life out of them. They don't really know how to report about it. And, you know, they don't really see how they can actually write a magazine about free software to have it readable by their readership. So the idea is that they do a monthly magazine, and every month's magazine focuses on one topic. Now, they'll do a topic on, you know, the IMF. They do a whole magazine on the IMF, but which is a hell, you know, can you imagine how boring that must be? But but it really scared them, the idea of doing a magazine on free software. But perfectly timing-wise, this November issue was going to be about ethical shopping, about all the ways that you can have a, you know, a greener impact, I guess, a better impact on the world. And they did a two-page spread in this on free software in cooperation with Bruce Byfield, who a number of you might know. He writes for OSTG, you know, the NewsForge slash dot. His stories appear up everywhere. But good old Bruce, I've been working with him now for the best part of a year, and he's, I describe him as a social activist, and he's a journalist, technology journalist. And this is the opening line of that two-page spread on free software. And, you know, it's a very exciting time, I think, to have these kinds of messages going into the readership of the New Internationalists, which they're the teachers of the world, they're the people who work for NGOs, they work, you know, in government, when they come from the church backgrounds, you know, the people who work for Oxfam, Christian Aid. That's the kind of readership of New Internationalist. And it sent a strong message that free software was an issue alongside environmentalism. It's as important as environmentalism. You know, we can't live in a world and focus just on one issue because they're all connected. And the problem with too much of a focus on one issue, like recycling, then if you, get, you might get recycling right, but you might miss out on everything else. You might miss out on freedom somewhere. So in January, the Green Party in the UK have now adopted an agenda, which is for free software. This is huge. This is, you know, this is the UK and the US, I think, represent the bastions, the places we need to break. I mean, we hear a lot about government action in other countries in Europe where free software is getting in the door, but the UK and the US represent the biggest problem areas because Microsoft is just so dominant there. But here now we have Derek Wall, who's basically heads up the Green Party in the UK, taking such a strong stand, not only for free software, but clearly against DRM as well. And with the launch of Vista, they made some very aggressive comments about Vista. And Friends of the Earth International, again, free software is their issue now as well. Friends of the Earth International offices in the Netherlands, which is their largest office, has switched all over to free software. Well, that's not quite right. They've got a few Microsoft machines left, but they've actually taken a plunge, you know, to back up their political stance on free software. Interestingly, the New Internationalists, where I worked, used to work, they've now switched to free software too. So it's happening, it's starting to happen. And what's important about that, why that's important, and this is something that John's going to cover, John Sullivan's going to cover in his talk about Vista, is the pressure that we're trying to apply to the big manufacturers, HP, Dell, and Sun. Sun, although they don't at the moment really do hardware for for the consumer, they might, I think. certainly with Ian Murdoch going on board, that's an interesting move by Sun as well. And Sun have done an awful lot this year with the opening of Java to GPL, and looks like Solaris will be heading that way, hopefully. But, you know, they're the manufacturers, they can make the difference. We're trying to apply pressure to them. They have, all of them, issues about greening themselves. We've got Green Party, Friends of the Earth International, and a list of others now that are going to be helping us make the claim that they need to help those organizations with free software. Because Richard would probably not mention it himself, I just want to point out for you all, just to remind you all what a great year it's been for Richard's world tour. You know, Richard travels all the time. We very, very rarely see him, actually, because he's traveling all the time. And he's traveling because he's basically the main advocate we have for free software. An interesting list of countries. But, you know, the point is that they have made the switch, and they've made the switch not in the sense they've actually done the switch yet, but they've made a switch politically. They've decided, they backed up with statements now that they're going to move to free software. And in fact, also Richard had a meeting with, if I can get her name correct, which I won't, Ségolène Royal. She's a French president candidate. She's not leading at the moment, which is a pity, but the right wing candidate's in front at the moment. But Richard met with her early in 2006, and they issued a joint statement basically about free software. So it's an interesting idea that, you know, we've got a leader who can get in front of presidents and prime ministers, make the case for free software, and actually get success. So what's LibrePlanet? Let's wrap this up quickly. LibrePlanet is a kind of idea that we had from last year's meeting. How do we get people to do more of this? How do we get people to do more action? How do we get it to be local? We've got Open Document out there. Microsoft is scared out of their life about it. We know that people don't want to switch to Vista. How can we accelerate people to switch to free software? One of the key things is the pressure points, the areas where budgets mean that free software actually make a much better choice, like schools, like your local church, like your local government, all those areas. Those areas need local action. People who know the politicians, know the newspapers to write to, know how to make a difference. A lot of people in this room already make a difference in that front. They do install FES, they write to the editors, they campaign for free software. But how do we do that more effectively? And that's what LibrePlanet's about. LibrePlanet is also an idea from Josh Gay, who's here today. Josh, where are you? So Josh is working on this concept. How do we help put together activists in a more effective way? You over there, you hate Open Document. This guy over here hates Open Document too. How can we get you together, make you more effective at doing something about Open Document on a national level? We could do something on a local level as well, but how can we share resources? It turns out that we found out 2 or 3 years ago that Ithaca Free Software, to us, that's such an amazing thing. Here's this group doing so much, really pushing free software on all fronts. And they came to the members' meeting, Mitch is here. And for us, that was a real awakening. And it turns out we here in Boston, we have Binary Freedom. Is Binary Freedom here yet today? So we have another group here, Binary Freedom. And again, an activism group based around free software. Turns out there's actually quite a lot of groups like that. We want to help join them up, make them aware of each other's work, and put together the individuals who've got specific interests and ideas about activism, about whether it is about, to do an event for free software, whether it's to do, some real effective stuff on Open Document. We're a 501c3. Very hard for us to do a lot of political stuff, but there's nothing stopping small groups from doing it. And a small group can have an amazing effect. So that's where we think LibrePlanet's going to be going. Nothing's put together yet, but that's the idea behind it. So there are these groups out there. There are these issues. And this year, the FSF is going to basically be trying to make this happen. So that's about the acceleration. We're at a point now where the FSF has got a distribution which it quite likes. It likes GNU Sense. It's very usable. We're about to have the hardware, we believe, that hardware free from restrictions. And now we need to do the next step, which is to get free software into the hands of people in a meaningful way. So that's it for me. Sorry, I've taken up too much time. Sorry, John. So any questions? Yes?
How do you overcome the resistance against Open Document format that people say, well, we don't know how to use anything about Windows?
Mm-hmm. Good question. How do you overcome it? Has anyone got any answers to that? Because I don't know. Bruce knows.
So I put a user down at a GNU Linux desktop with all of the tools that we know and love. And about a month later, I walked over to that, put it in the virtual terminal. And the user walked up and said, well, how do I get this back to Windows? Oh, you don't have Windows. And the user never picked that up. And the fact is that what they actually understand is a certain visual paradigm that we can very aptly provide them today. And I think that there is some work to do on the usability of Open Office and the usability of some of our other software. But if you don't want to do anything really sophisticated, our desktops are just fine for those. So one of the things that I've been thinking about, and since many of you out here do not have a six-year-old growing up and might have more time than me, you could try this, is just go set up in some place where a lot of people walk through with some tables and laptops and have people sit down and say, would you like to try a new Linux system? We'd like to see if you can actually do something with this. And I think that everyone would learn something from this. And you can, if you set it up in advance, get a lot of good press for it as well.
Mm. Yeah, so there's something about forcing people to do things as well. You know, if we can get local authorities, local government, to make the switch, to decide to use free software for their schools, you know, that's the kind of way. I mean, why do people use Microsoft? Well, it's because they went to work and it was there. So when they went home, that's what they purchased as well. So there's a certain amount of, you know, we just use it because it's there. So in some ways, if we can convince the local churches, the schools to make that switch, find the people who can make those decisions. You know, people come and look at my laptop and they don't have a clue, in fact, that it's not something that they would be familiar with. That's where we are now. We're at a place where there isn't really any difference, in my opinion. I mean,
there might or might not be a difference, but they think there's a difference.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I think just by using it is...
They're scared of it.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But, you know, people buy new products all the time. I mean, people are going to go out and buy the iPhone. That's going to have a new graphical user interface they've never used before. So I think those kinds of worries are kind of, you know, people are using Firefox a lot, don't forget, and they are using these free software products. So, you know, if we, you know, they don't necessarily have to be scary because they don't need to be presented in that way. So.
What about trying to pass things at the local level to encourage the use of free software? Mary and I have worked on town meeting.
Yep.
And trying to figure out.
That's what LibrePlanet is. That you're right. That's exactly what we should do. You know, because you know, at that local level, it's amazing. Someone who's got a strong opinion is willing to stand up and say something like that.
Right,
you know.
Introducing a warrant article at town meeting or something like that. On the order of some of these, I think the Venezuela legislation to say that they had to consider open source.
Yeah. I think that's exactly the way we can go. There was talk previously of doing something like that here in Cambridge, getting one of the local politicians to make that kind of a push. Those are exactly the sorts of things that can make a difference. And that's the sort of thing that we're going to try and help people do in this coming year. I don't want to take up too much more time, so one more question.
Just something to raise to awareness on is the fact, I think it's been termed now e-waste, where the migration to Windows Vista has such high hardware requirements that people are going to be junking otherwise good machines in mass. And as a result, there is real waste being generated.
Yeah.
And it's causing pollution to actually make this migration.
Yeah, in fact, that's one of the statements made by the Green Party. They were saying that in a million years, you'll be able to see the Vista upgrade in the archaeology. There'll be this, which I think is a very good point. You're right. I mean, look around the room. There's lots of battered old computers around, all running the latest and greatest. You know, you're right. So that's exactly right. You know, there's a great case to be made there. There's always been this very close relationship between Microsoft and the chip manufacturers. You know, look, if you really want us to preload your stuff, you've got to deliver a requirement for upgrade. And, you know, but I think we're at a point now where the manufacturers have to are breaking that cycle. And I think that's why Dell and HP and others are getting to a point now where they're really making these kinds of moves we want to see.